Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part of what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm so delighted to have two of my absolute favorite women in food with me in the studio, Christine Mulkey, the executive editor of Bon Appetit magazine, and Dori Greenspan, the celebrated cookbook author who I think has taught us all how to bake. Christine and Dori are both experts in all things writing, cooking, baking, and Paris, and they're also two of the most stylish women in New York who can make radio headphones even look okay. Thank you both.
It's your bang story. No, she's talking about you, Christine.
Thank you both so much for coming on the show, and especially Dori for making a long trip to get here. From the confines of this radio studio in Bushwick, I thought it could be fun to start out by talking about Paris, which is a place both of you sometimes call home. How did you each find yourselves there in the first place?
Dori, you go first.
Well, I go first only because I found myself there before you. I went there. So here's my life story. I was born, I got married, I went to Paris. I feel like that's, you know, and it all happened very, very quickly. I went to Paris for the first time 43 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my husband got some money from an insurance policy that he turned in, and he was going to pay off the car, and I bought tickets to go to Paris instead. He was a grumpy traveler for that trip. But I got there, and I felt like everything in my life changed. I was young, so I'd never had that experience before, but I'm not so young, and I've never had it since. There was just this connection to Paris, and all I wanted to do was be there.
Was it a place that had been sort of talked about with other people in your life before? Or?
Yeah, it was kind of dreamy. You know, it was that romantic vision of Paris, this beautiful, beautiful city. But I got there, and I don't know whether it was just the feel of the rhythm of the city. It was certainly the strawberry tart that I had. It just changed everything for me, including my relationship to my mother, who had made the mistake of not having me in Paris. Poor judgment. I've been trying to make up for it, yeah, all my life.
That's so funny. What about you, Christine?
I started studying French at a very young age. Met some girls that were visiting their grandmother when I was visiting my grandmother in Florida when I was 5 or 6, and I just thought it was the most glamorous thing ever that they got to read Babar in French and Dr. Seuss, Les Auvergnats Jambon. I was like, sure. And was able to start studying it and just absolutely fell in love with French. And as sort of a lonely, wonky kid in the Midwest, you know, doing your French homework sort of seemed like a ticket to something better. And then went there with a class trip when I was 13 or 14. And it just absolutely, like with Dori said, it was home. And then I guess almost 20 years later, I had sold a place with my ex, and we had a little bit of money, and which not enough money for anything in New York or Queens or anywhere, but enough for something in Paris at the time, and just sort of made a lifelong dream come true to have a foothold there.
And how often do you both get there now, and how much time do you spend?
I'm there about 4 months of the year in chunks, so I get to see the seasons change, but I guess the longest I'm there is about a month.
Yeah.
I know. It's so weird.
I'm setting long-term goals. I go usually for Thanksgiving every year, and then if I have a story on top of that, I mean, one of the bonuses in publishing is, you know, if you say, oh, well, if I get to go to Paris for the story, you don't have to put me up anywhere, and they're like, ha-ha. So I usually go once a year, but I was there a year ago Thanksgiving, and then this year I was there last Monday for 24 hours.
24 hours.
So when you have a kid, that kind of changes things. You're in a fifth floor walk up.
What does it mean for both of you to have sort of a foothold in both countries? What has the impact been on your life and your work?
You know, I know that my work has changed because of it. You know, I didn't learn French at an early age the way Christine did, but when I came back from Paris for that first trip, I tried to learn. When our kid was born, I insisted that we have a French au pair so that I could learn French. And I was able to start working with French chefs because I could speak the language. And that made a big difference to me. Living in France has meant that I really can work in France, that I have the access, really, to people who can share recipes with me, that I have a kitchen so I can cook, I can invite friends in and make that part of my work, which has been wonderful.
For me, definitely on the work front, I mean, I used to joke when I would go back to Mount Holyoke College to talk about what in the world can you actually do with a French major. I would say, well, I could, at the first I would say, I can pronounce the specials really well when I'm waitressing. But then I got to work with French chefs and work with them in French, and I was super honored by the poor judgment of the people at Mad Food Symposium. I got to translate for Alain Sandoran this summer. They should have hired a professional, but it was such a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And also trying to get things done in Paris actually makes New York seem really easy.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, I just got...
Like getting a gas line installed or something.
Oh, or figuring out why your tax forms are still coming when you thought you had paid everything.
Oh, but now you can pay them by phone. There's an app. They actually have a tax app in France.
I'm so glad to see you today. Thank you. Merci.
We know what we'll be setting up during the break.
There you go. Impo.gouv.
Thanks.
So speaking of sort of, for you, Dory Paris, making your work quite different, it seems that it was really the subject of your latest cookbook, which I would probably call a baking book more than anything. I'll let you pronounce the title because we were joking about...
Yeah, we were joking about it earlier. Baking Chez Moi, baking from my house.
And it's all about the desserts that are made in French home kitchens and recipes you gathered from all these people that you have in your life in Paris. And
yes. So this was... I had written... my book before that, Around My French Table, I think it was kind of the savory version of this, kind of elbows on the table food that French people make at home. And these are the desserts. And in collecting recipes for this book, I felt like I discovered a parallel universe. You know, not when we say French pastry, most of us, and certainly I for a long, long time, felt that we were talking about pastry shops. We were talking about beautiful, polished, perfect pastries made by professionals. There's a whole other world out there, and it's French home baking that you don't get to see very often, because the kinds of things that French people bake at home, they only bake for family. Most French people, my French friends are such great cooks, but if you ask them if they bake, they'll say, no, I don't really bake.
I love the story you told in the introduction about presenting, I think it was a chocolate cake with layers of berries and ganache and a glaze and all the stuff, and you presented it, and then everyone asked you why you made it.
That's right. Yeah. They said, where did you buy it? And I said, I made it, kind of throwing back my shoulders with pride. And their response was, why? Why? Baking like that is left to the pros. So it was really exciting to find these really simple loaf cakes, the cup custards, the poached fruits, the kinds of things that, you know, French people make on a Tuesday night just for family.
It's so wonderful. And did you, when you started gathering the recipes for the book, which I guess was about 5 years ago, did you know that it was going to turn into a book, or you just started asking what people made at home? How did that come
about? Well, I actually have been, I feel like I've been collecting recipes since the first day I went to Paris. I had just never really thought about home baking. And so I started to ask my friends, what do you have when I'm not there? You know, when you're not going to Pierre Hermé and buying something beautiful, you know, what are you having? And I asked them to bake those things for me and to serve them to me. And they did. But then when I asked them for the recipes, they said no. You know, my good friends. But I think it's because... I mean, nobody said no to me for Around My French Table, for savory cooking. everybody knew their food was good. I think that it's just that because the French don't have this tradition of baking at home, there wasn't the same confidence in home baking.
It's so interesting.
It was fascinating, yeah. Really.
Your friends who contributed recipes to your book and gave you these amazing stories and these really simple but wonderful recipes, what has their response been now that it's in print?
Well, okay, so they haven't seen it because I haven't been back yet. But some of my friends saw, this is so funny, some of my friends saw the pictures when the proofs came. I was editing in Paris, and I showed my friend Bernard the picture of the Mocha Dupont, which was his birthday cake from the time he was three. And it was one of the most surprising recipes because I was waiting for a birthday cake. And when I finally got the recipe, it was for an icebox cake made with store-bought cookies, right? And so I showed him the picture, and he said, "That's not my birthday cake." I said, "What do you mean it's not your birthday cake?" He said, "Well, you didn't put the squiggles on the side." A grown man. He said, "And ice cream? There's ice cream in that picture. We would never have ice cream." I think everybody else will be happy to see their recipes.
That's too funny.
But I love that it blows the lid off on our perceptions of French, you know, another French myth laid down. I mean, you look at the French woman, you think, oh my God, she's so impossibly chic and her clothes must come from here and there. And they all shop at Monoprix.
I think I'm curious, Christine, what your impression is about the difference between kind of these homemade desserts, especially in France, versus ones you would buy in a pastry shop. And as someone who's, I consider a connoisseur of all good things across the board, high and low and everything, what do you think distinguishes those two and what do you look for in them?
I've never been lucky enough to be served a homemade pastry in someone's home. When I go,
you're invited.
They always get something, you know, Pierre Hermé or
absolutely.
Arnaud Larreur makes those fantastic chocolate cakes. So I would love to be served an icebox cake or a simple tart or, you know, poached pears, please. So reading Dory's book was a real, it was like visiting a new country, which was so much fun. So fortunately, I can't speak to that.
Waiting your invitation.
You're always welcome. Chez moi. You too, Julia. But it's interesting that you say that that you haven't been invited to have these kinds of desserts. I was so surprised by finding these recipes because I really did feel that I had discovered something unknown before. It sounds so strange, I know, but and also, Julian, when you asked, you know, how my work has been affected by living in Paris, I couldn't have gotten these recipes if I didn't live in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the great things about being a writer is it just gives you license to be nosy.
But not too nosy. Have you noticed, our first apartment had a window that looked out on a cobblestone courtyard. And on Saturday night, you would hear the tap, tap, tap of high heels on cobblestone as these elegantly dressed women would be tossing out their trash before serving dinner to friends on Saturday night. And you would see all the boxes from all the takeout places.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? So you can't be too nosy. You can't like go to the kitchen and say, "I'll help with the dishes." Your host will come right out and grab the dishes from you in the hallway and not let you behind that kitchen door.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Is it because dinner was decanted?
Dinner was from decanted. Picard. Yeah, it's from the frozen food store. Yeah.
It's so interesting because I think for people who do cook and bake at home often, and if you entertain, I think the savory food you make, there can be a wide range of things in sort of my experience more than in baking. And I feel like with baking, people tend to have a smaller repertoire of things they make. So it's sort of asking them to give over these sort of, you know, these prized almost secrets and the small collection of things that is true to them. And
I think it's more true in France. I mean, we Americans are such do-it-yourselfers. And Christine, you know this from the magazine, from Bon Appetit, because you always present something that can be, you know, put together very simply and something that can be a challenge. And I think we Americans love to cook and bake, love a challenge. We'll spend all weekend making something. Not so the French.
But we're also crazy enough that we would tackle that project for the first time for an important party on Friday, whereas the French are smart enough to know, hey, I'm making Tante Claire's apple galette because I've made it 99 times and it's going to work.
Bingo.
Whereas I'm, you know, like growing apples or something.
No, I think Americans are also much more stressed out.
Yes.
stressed out? Stressed?
What's that? I want to talk a little bit about just cookbooks in general, and I think it's something that you guys are both quite involved in. It's a topic I'm partial to, and I'm wondering what you think the role is of a cookbook these days and how cookbooks have changed over the years and what purpose they serve.
Well, we're definitely in a cookbook bubble, and I'm very grateful for that. There's so many of them. I mean, ultimately, it shouldn't just be to inspire you, but that's a big part. I mean, when you read a cookbook in bed or the first time you read it, you should be creating that dinner party, or you're bringing people together over the things that you're envisioning making
Absolutely.
In your kitchen. But then, more importantly, you should actually be able to make them, and they should become those sticky, dog-eared pages in your book. Like, I was just going through Claudia Fleming's book,
The Last Course,
which I'm lucky enough to have two copies of, because that shit's expensive on Amazon now. It's so
Sadly out of print.
But
yeah.
Things are so stuck together because those recipes work. And a lot of cookbooks are not tested, I've found. Not ones I've worked on. And
Nor I.
So it should be to inspire, it should be to teach, and it should be to become a part of your life. It should be that apple... I mean, it should be the lemon, Meyer lemon and chocolate tart from Suzanne Gowen's cookbook that you make every year for this one event. And I think, you know, the chef's cookbooks, those are on the level of inspiration, but they should also have a practical application. Even if there's just a tiny takeaway from, let's say, David Kinch's Manresa book, it's, you know, putting leek tops in your stock actually makes it clearer. So something like that.
You know, I think you've described, in talking about what cookbooks should be, I think you've described kind of the way I feel, and it's probably the way you two feel as well about working on books. You work on a book because you want to share something. It's not an activity that you do just for yourself. And while I'm writing, I'm always thinking about the reader, the home cook, the home baker, and what it's going to be like in his or her kitchen. But... You want everything to work. The reason you work on recipes and test them is because you want people to be successful. I feel like a cheerleader, you know, that I'm home, or the baking evangelist, I sometimes say. You know, I'm home saying, come on, you can do it, bake. But I think it's important for that to be part of a cookbook. Mm-hmm. That things have to work. Yes, you have to inspire people, but you also have to help them. And I love, Christine, as you said, that we are in a cookbook bubble. There's some great books out this season.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, when you're doing the annual cookbook roundup, it's very hard to limit it. But I actually used to review cookbooks, and I would start out every season with maybe 30 that looked really great, and I would cook 3 recipes from each one of those books, and I would inevitably end up with 10 to 15 that I actually thought were workable. And actually, Dory, I made your buckwheat chocolate sablé this weekend. I brought them, and I was hoping you could tell me what I did. They're a little... I think they're delicious, and I thought the toasting the buckwheat was a really good step, but they're just a tiny bit tough. Can you tell me if I overworked them, please?
Let me see. Look at how cute they are. Oh, they're adorable. I'll take a picture on Instagram. Okay.
When did you make them?
I did them yesterday. I was supposed to bring them to something and then I forgot. But that's another thing about cookbooks is, like, you know that people are going to take the time not only to do the shopping but also to make the cookies, and they're going to spend money and they're going to spend time. You know, now as a new mother who has just these tiny windows in which, you know, I toasted the flour on Saturday night and then I baked it on Sunday.
Hi, Julia.
But you really want it to work.
I think you could have baked them a little longer.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they have a slightly under... They have that nice snap, but... Did you put all the salt in them that you were supposed to?
I don't know.
I think you could use a little salt, too.
And I also... What did I not do that I was supposed to do?
No, okay. No, no.
I think this should be a segment on each show.
What did I do wrong?
No,
but that's interesting because I make your chocolate sablé every mm-hmm. year, and you specifically say take them out. They won't look done, but take them
but
out.
But that's a completely different cookie. You're talking about the World Peace cookie.
It's the Pierre Hermé chocolate sablé that you did in T Magazine in like 2004.
Right. That became the world. That was the Korova cookie, chocolate sablé, became world peace. Yeah, that's a very different. Chocolate is a different story.
Okay.
Yeah. This needs just a little bit more.
Well, I did 13 minutes. Maybe I go to 15.
Well, I love the toasted buckwheat flavor.
Well, that was such a good. And you had such good suggestions. It's like, this is what it should smell like. This is what it should look like. And that's a lot of things that cooks forget to include. And it's like, how should it smell? How should it look? What are my cues?
I was just
be there with me
this past week editing a cookbook and sort of was going through the process of adding these cues. And I think these cues are something Dory excels in. I think it's why your books always stand out. And I think it is that feeling that you yourself described of being there in the kitchen and encouraging people, but also giving them everything they need to know so that things turn out hopefully just as well as they did for you. Yeah. Hmm.
And so that the reader can eventually make it their own recipe, you know.
I love that. Mm. And you must see that in the magazine. Well, I know I see it in the comments online for the magazine. Sometimes as a cookbook author, as a recipe creator, I'm frustrated when somebody doesn't follow my recipe. But most of the time, I want people to make them their own, to personalize them, to say, oh, you said I should put dark chocolate in, but I really like white chocolate, or I don't like chocolate, I want nuts, or, gee, this could use some cinnamon, or anything that makes it just the way you want it. I'm really excited when people do that.
It's great.
Mm. I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think you're giving people tools to really take home and empower themselves to make more things.
And Julia, how do you build that in when you're working on a cookbook with someone else? Are you in the kitchen with them, or you're testing everything?
What's the process?
Or when are you building in the cues in the text?
It's different each time, and it depends on the recipe and the subject matter. But for the most part, I try to observe as much as possible. And I think I have this whole plan that I want to pitch to Apple about how the iPhone has changed my work, because I'm able to take video and pictures so easily and go back to that when I'm writing, because I'm not necessarily writing in the moment. I used to take only notes by hand, and now I do that with a combination of more sort of visual cues just for myself and references, and that's really helpful when I go back to write the recipes. So I think I've remembered everything, but being able to see a picture or a video again makes me just remember things I didn't even realize were happening in the moment.
Yeah, J.J. Good, I learned that he does that, and I think that's part of why April's recipes are just so incredibly, it's like she's talking to you, and also they really work.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. The ability to take a picture has changed
everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And you have enough storage on your phone?
I clear it out.
Okay.
I have like this online file. It's probably an overly complicated system, but if it's not broken.
I'll get your tips after this.
I just want to ask you guys one more question before you go to break, which is for you, Christine, about the difference between working on books and working on magazine articles. And Dory, I think you've done both of those as well. Mm. And I'm curious what you think the difference is. And I think of cookbooks as hopefully these timeless things and magazines as more timely things. Do you agree with that?
Certainly. I mean, you do want to build something that doesn't have, that's not necessarily trend-based, because you do want it to be on someone's shelf in 10, 15 years. And we all love to go to yard sales and look at cookbooks and be like, oh my God, can you believe? But you also have the time in working on the text and the recipes to really sit with it, because you see it so many times, so many more times. I mean, Dory, I know you have a rigorous editing and copy editing process where they basically have to rip it out of her arms because she wants to go over it the 50th time. But I think that's why they are so valuable and so such keepsakes. We're lucky at Bon Appetit. We test every recipe multiple times, and even after it's approved, it then gets cross-tested by several other people to make sure that recipe works identically. And that's a real luxury. So I think in that case, our recipes do work as well as cookbook recipes, but you are making a more lasting document, I think.
What do you think, Dory?
I love magazines for... As a writer, I don't do as much magazine writing as I used to, but when I did, I loved that I could jump into a topic, learn as much as I could about it in a short time, write about it, and see something very quickly. Books take a very, very long time. As a reader, I love magazines because they bring the present world to me. I'm living with my book that is, lives on my desk for years and years and years. And sometimes, and I'm concentrating on one particular area. I love what magazines can do. I love that they can make you dream. They can take you away for a short time. They can introduce you to a new spice, to a new tradition. I love that, but I'll never give up cookbooks.
Yeah, and also just in terms of space constraints, you know, often we'll have to make a recipe fit into one column. So all of those cues that have been built in, that's one of the first things that you cut for space. So you can be a lot more generous with your information in a cookbook in a way that I think values the reader.
Absolutely. I think that's great. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be right back.
We're proud to count Brooklyn Slate as a business member of Heritage Radio Network. Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hideka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces to use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. We encourage you to visit brooklynslate.com to learn more. You can also get your own Brooklyn Slate care package by becoming a superfan member of Heritage Radio Network. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate for more.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hi, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and today I'm talking with Christine Mulkey and Dory Greenspan. Right before the break, we were talking about magazine writing versus book writing and all the details that come with book writing, and those are topics I could talk about all day. We were talking about the sort of nuances of recipe writing. But I wanted to take the second segment to talk not just about what you both do, but a little bit about the other moving parts of your lives and how you're able to make those support doing what you do. So the first sort of the big ideas is that you're both working mothers, and I know this is a loaded topic, and I feel like when women are asked about it, they're always asked for an answer. So I'd like to preface this by saying I'm not looking for any answer. I don't think there is one. I think if there is one, we probably wouldn't ask the question. So Dory, you've got a son who's now an adult. Christine, you have a very young son who's very adorable. What are some of
Wait
the ways...
Wait a second, you don't think my son's adorable?
He's very super he's handsome.
Joshua doesn't need any help.
I'm curious some of the ways you've both made it work and are making it work. If there's any thoughts or tips or stumbles or anything you'd like to share on the topic.
Well, the answer is there are no answers, and as an answers-oriented person, as I think any New Yorker is, that can be really challenging. But I'm just recently learning to kind of, I always joke about Coco Chanel's dictum that before you go out, you should look in the mirror and take one thing off, and now I look at my schedule and I'll take one thing off, or I'll think, you know, even yesterday when I was baking Dory's cookies and I was going out to a really fun event and had a sitter coming and I was trying to start the milk for the yogurt that I was also making. And I thought, do I really need to do that now? No, that's just going to make me exponentially crazier, and I could do it tonight. You know, so it's just, and that's a very, very small example, but you just really have to think, is this worth it, or will this benefit my family and myself? And, you know, do I really need to go to another store party? And just yeah, trying to figure out, and in terms of getting in extra work, because yeah, in addition to having a full-time job, I also write books with chefs on the side. It's nights and weekends. So
you make homemade yogurt?
I make homemade yogurt. Well, it's about as hands-off as you can get, but you get to take a lot of credit for it.
And she grows her own apples for the apple time. Yeah. But actually, that's great advice, whether you have a kid or not. That's just great get-through-the-day, get-through-your-life advice, to just look at that schedule and take one thing off. I always add, but I add the one thing I can do, so I can check it off the list.
I love that.
Yeah, but that's kind of crazy.
I've written lists before with some, and I've included something that I've already done, not just something I can do, so I can start the list with something crossed off. So I feel
whatever
I've already
it takes.
Whatever
exactly.
It is.
It's so great.
The time it takes me to write the list, I could probably be doing something else.
It's so great how we can fool ourselves. But, you know, it's a lot of years since I've had to worry about juggling, you know, kid, family life, work, husband. And as I look back, I think I was so lucky because I had a lot of help. I had a husband who worked at home for the first 5 years, and I did. Why this kid is even halfway normal? I mean, he lived in a, you know, almost like in an aquarium with all of us watching him at all times, you know, but he's fine. And I think that having help, finding a way to, I've met so many mothers who feel they have to do it all themselves, that they can't share, that they don't want to ever leave a kid with a friend or a family member. One of the things that I felt so strongly when Joshua was younger and I was working, was the need for some time for myself, guilt-free time. Whether it was to go out and see friends or whether it was to be able to work really, really quietly. And I think it's important to find ways to have that quiet time without the guilt that can sometimes be associated with it.
Airplane time.
Airplane time.
It's an excuse to go to Paris.
And you're leaving. Leaving the kid with someone. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it reminds me of what you were saying earlier about this idea of sort of women in France having everything together and looking so put together and chic and all these things, but then you're seeing them put their takeout containers out and they're still entertaining and they're spending time with people they love, and maybe they didn't make everything from scratch,
exactly.
But you know, they're making it work, and I think there's something to that.
And they're not talking about it endlessly.
Yeah.
They're very discreet, which is sort of the hardest thing for me as an American to learn about, is, you know, There's just a lot that you don't talk about.
Wait, I have to tell you a great story. We went to, this is years ago, before we had an apartment in Paris and before I knew what the supermarkets were like. We went to a friend's home for dinner. She was a horrible cook. And Michael, my husband, and I were already planning what we would eat when we got home. And she served a quiche that was absolutely delicious. And the crust was so beautiful. And I said to her, oh, this crust, it's fabulous. How did you do it? And she said, I'm so glad you liked it.
That's great.
Right?
That's terrific.
And I think that's the way the French are about.
Less is more.
Beautiful.
Right?
I don't think I have that filter, but I'm going to try to install it in my brain.
Okay, and when you get it in there, you let me know how you did it.
Right? No, it's a helpful story. I think knowing what to share and what you don't need to share is equally as important. My next sort of big picture question isn't just about being a working parent, but is about being a working woman. And I think it's so interesting. We've talked a lot about on Radio Cherry Bomb and in the magazine and everything about how male-dominated the food industry is, especially the restaurant industry. But I don't think the scales are tipped so dramatically in the world of publishing. And I think both of you are great examples, and I think there's so many more great examples of successful writers and editors and even literary agents and photographers and publishers and book designers, all of whom are women. And I'm wondering if you agree about sort of the publishing world having a lot of great women in it, and thoughts on why that is.
I think the publishing world does have a lot of great women in it, But we're also talking about, or it sounds like you're talking about, a publishing world that also is, whose audience is women. So talking about, right, cookbooks, talking about food magazines, talking about, it's a female world. Though if you look, I mean, if you look back to the 20s, or, I mean, if you just think about publishing, all the great editors we know were men.
Although I think about the 1950s and Mademoiselle and things like that, I think it was sort of an acceptable ladies' profession.
Only then, if you wore your white gloves to work.
Exactly, yeah. With your little Sylvia Plath handbag. And, I don't know, and it's interesting. It's always, I mean, the snappy answer is to say, well, it's because we're great multitaskers. But it's certainly not because women have gotten other women into the industry. Within the industry, it's not, there's not a lot of mentorship or support, which is very surprising and disappointing, and kind of one of the rude shocks. It's sort of a different form of sexism in a way. Having gone to a women's college, like when there are limited resources available, like you kind of start killing each other over small things, and I've definitely experienced that. So I'm trying to encourage other women or help other women within the industry, but it's kind of, that's one of the things that's not talked about either.
I think that's so interesting, because the jobs are scarce and there aren't that many. So well, I think if you are any person, a woman or a man or anything in a certain position, maybe being a mentor or trying to welcome more people into it might not be, I guess, the wisest thing for your job, which
but
is
it
so interesting.
It feels so good to help other people.
Absolutely.
But, Christine, you made me think of a line that I hadn't thought of in years, and it was applied to academia. And the line was, the backbiting is so fierce because the rewards are so small. and you could have said that was true in food, but it's not true any longer.
Mm-hmm.
As there are really successful, I hate the term celebrity chefs, but you know what I mean when I say it. So it's not just, you know, I love to start a sentence like this. When I worked with Julia Child, I remember when I worked with Julia Child and we were once talking about cookbook advances, and she said, I don't think people should get a lot of money to write cookbooks. They should earn that money. And I often think when I read about the, you know, million-dollar advances that people are getting, chefs, and I think, What would Julia say?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the world is a different place now. And so if the backbiting is fierce, it's because the rewards are greater now.
Interesting. I also think about something that Kim Hastrider, the editor, co-editor of Paper Magazine, told me when I was working there. I just started. And she said, as this was her highest form of compliment, she said, oh, good, I can see with working with you that you're a Soviet. I'm like, what do you mean? She said, you're one of the Soviet women. We're the ones who are out in the fields all day harvesting the potatoes while the men sit around, you know, playing cards and drinking vodka. And I've been lucky enough to be surrounded by Soviet women, you know, throughout my career, because it's a huge slog. And, you know, it's a very special personality that signs up for the type of cyclical, you know, work crush that is magazine publishing, but that is
cookbook editing. You know, the spring list, the fall list.
Right.
The, yeah.
I mean, it really is no shirkers allowed. So I wonder if that, you know, if we want to make any gender comparisons there.
On the other hand, okay. So when I had a hard time getting a job as working in a kitchen. It was 1981. And now, granted, I wouldn't have hired me. I had absolutely no experience. But I had such enthusiasm, and I was willing to do anything. And I got turned away from my first job interview because the chef, who spoke to me only in French without asking me if I spoke French, said, I'm looking for a boy. I'm looking for a boy. And at the time, somebody said to me, well, you'll never get a job unless you go to the CIA. And I said, well, I'm married. I have a baby. I don't think I can go to this. She said, well, then you're not committed enough. A man would do that, she said to me. And now I look at kitchens and think, you know, we've come a long way, baby. It's a real difference. Granted, that's, what, 25 years or so? But still, I mean, I think things have really changed, and there are more women doing spectacular jobs that, you know, I didn't think would be possible at the time that I was being turned away.
So, I'm curious, sort of with all these themes in mind, for both of you, and you can choose which order you answer this in, but if both of you could dial back knowing what you know now and give advice to your sort of 20 or 25-year-old self, what would you say?
Dory, you go first.
Well, I know what I would say. I would say don't be afraid. You know, I was a scaredy cat. I was the kid in the back of the room who wouldn't raise her hand because she didn't want to speak in public. I was always sure that I couldn't do anything. And if I did do something and I did do a good job, I thought the next time I would have to start from square one and prove that I needed to do it all over again. I would just tell myself to be bold. Don't be afraid. I mean, I tell everybody to say yes. And the fact is, I have said yes. I've said yes when I've been really, really scared. But it would have been nice to say yes and not be so scared.
Yeah, I think not being afraid is really important. And also not being afraid to leave. Because, I mean, people stay in jobs for a long time because they think, well, I'm working at X, or this is such a great opportunity.
So
whereas
important.
you watch them kind of disappear. And you think, well, how can I possibly... You become so associated with that publication that you're afraid to go anywhere else. And, I mean, leaving has always been the best thing I've ever done, even though I thought I would never survive. I mean, I'm just talking in general.
No, but that's great. Leaving is really... Leaving anything, I think.
I mean, if I look at a resume and I see someone's leaving every year, every 18 months, I mean, I definitely think you should say 2-3 years. But after 5 years, you really have to start taking other choices for yourself and not just thinking, well, because also no one has a lifetime unless you're at Vanity Fair. But no one, you know, State or New Yorker. No, there's no, you know, there are no tenure track jobs in publishing anymore. And I think more now than ever, you have to get more and more different kinds of experience, digital. Even some would say marketing, in order to stay relevant and stay ahead of the fireball.
It's good advice.
It's great advice. And much more lighthearted questions. I just left enough time for both of you for the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which are the 7 questions I ask everyone who comes on. No pressure, no major life lessons, just fun. So, Dory, I'm going to start with you. I think I know the answer, but I'm curious. Sweet or salty?
Am I allowed to answer both?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, both.
What about you, Christine?
Both.
Both. Dory, what did you have for breakfast today?
I had oatmeal that spilled all over the stove. I wasn't paying attention.
I had oatmeal with sour cherries, chia, and a canelé, and a couple of these buckwheat sablé, and some matcha with almond milk and agave.
It's well-rounded.
Oh, and some kombucha that I made.
Well, of course you made it.
You had all the buzzwords in one.
Fermentation, a celebration.
Do you put your chia seeds in the oatmeal while it's cooking or after?
After. I just do a sprinkle, and I don't want to let them sit there for too long.
Dory, if I were to look into your refrigerator right now, and you can pick whichever home or any refrigerator, what might I be surprised to find?
Oh, what might you be surprised? I don't think anything in... Is this true? I don't think anything in my refrigerator is surprising. At least I hope not. I mean, there might be a surprise.
For you, a surprise.
There's not a secret shame drawer?
No. I mean, you'd find what you expect. I always keep about 3 dozen eggs and about 4 pounds of butter in the refrigerator. Because maybe that would surprise you.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, because you never know when a baking urge might strike.
What kind of butter?
I'm using Cabot's butter.
What about you, Christine? What might I be surprised to find?
Nail polish, because I don't paint my nails.
So
it's archival.
It's archival. That's so funny. Dory, what's your go-to snack?
It used to be a bowl of rice. I would make rice in the morning and then nibble it all through the day. Yogurt.
Yogurt. That's terrific.
I always have almonds with me.
raw, roasted?
Raw.
What's your favorite time of day?
Not 4 o'clock, which I refer to as the hypoglycemic hours. Morning, early morning.
Yeah, I could do my entire day's work between the hours of 9 and 12.
Absolutely.
Or I think 10 o'clock is my favorite writing time, 9:30, 10.
Yep. In the morning.
Yeah.
Dory, where would you like to travel to next?
Japan.
I'm sitting next to her, holding the bag of travel socks for Dory. Yes,
and almonds. My last question, Dory, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oh, so my mother says that my favorite meal was a lamb chop, and that she hated the smell of it. And that probably tells you everything you need to know about my relationship to my mother as a cook. My favorite meal was scrambled eggs, actually. Yeah.
For me, my mother's lasagna or fried chicken, and then with a birthday cake chaser, and that would be for breakfast. Leftover lasagna is probably my favorite.
And what kind of birthday cake?
Vanilla with chocolate.
Chocolate frosting.
Yeah.
The way to go. That's so great. Well,
thank
you for breakfast. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today. Christine, where can listeners find you online? What are all your handles?
Well, for some reason, when I signed up for Twitter, I thought Christine Mulkey was a good handle, just taking up all 140 characters right there. So Christine Mulkey on Twitter and XteenM on Instagram, and of course, always at bonappetit.com.
What about you, Dory?
I'm Dory Greenspan for everything. Yes, DoryGreenspan.com, DoryGreenspan Twitter, DoryGreenspan Instagram.
Yay. Yeah.
All the channels. And just a reminder, your new book, Baking Chez Moi, is out in bookstores and available online. And I am guessing everyone who will buy a copy, it will be as dog-eared as mine already is very soon.
Thank you.
As always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.